Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
So I went down to my favorite store, picked out three or four shirts or more, a pair of pants and a striped tie, and the man came by and said, "Yes, sir, cash or charge?" I said, "Just put it on my credit card." "Write that dude up." "Oh, convenient. Now I put that card away in a drawer, and I never charged $1 more. Then one day in the mail, I got this bill. Typed on a card all full of holes, it said, "Do not staple, bend, or fold," was the astronomical figure of $3,200.42. When? There's been a mistake. So I got on the phone. "Hello, hello. I got Mr. Black and Mr. Brown, and then I got the runaround, till finally Mr. Green came on the line. I said, "Sir, this may be hard to take, but your computer has made a mistake. It says I owe more money than I've ever seen." And he said, "People like you make mistakes. Computers do not lie. Send us the bread. TDQ. Well, now this has just about done me in, so I grabbed that computer card again, the one with all those holes punched out so nice. And I threw it on the floor and I stomped it twice, and I whipped out my pocket knife and punched out a few new holes, for there hadn't been no holes before, then I've been a double.
You know where that's going. That's Dick Feller, the credit card song, top 10, 1974, on the country charts, and his frustration, well known to most of us in the early computer days. In fact, for some of us, those punch cards that arrived in the latter 60s, were our first introduction, and they always said, "Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate," and for whatever reason, I always felt the need to bite them, and there was nothing about biting them on them, but in the case of the Dick Feller song, of course, he wound up getting thousands of dollars from the credit card company. Don't you wish? Yes, because computers don't lie. Well, unfortunately, people using them do, and that goes to the heart of scams, and an ethical hacker, Jason Glassberg, has all the answers, so welcome back, Jason.
Yeah, nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. I think more every day that goes by, there's another scam that's out there. And, of course, your firm, Casaba Security, is doing it on a much bigger level. But as far as individuals, what are the latest scams running out there?
Well, a lot of them have to do with, obviously, being stuck at home, the virus, right? Mm-hmm. The cures, unemployment, government benefits. And most of them really, they're playing on folks' fear, greed, and otherwise just, taking advantage of a very bad situation. A lot of them involve phishing, fake emails, fake websites, fake SMS messages, and malicious apps that pretend to be one thing and wind up doing another. And the fact that there are so many people now either working from home, taking school courses at home, or just generally being stuck in their house means that more people than ever are, online, and it just means that the pool of potential victimhood is that much greater.
Oh, astronomically, especially when you're talking about school from home, because we now have computers introduced into family settings where maybe they were not used prior to this. And if it hasn't happened already, that all the scams are going to use all the logos of the schools and everything else that make it look so darn official. So
older folks also, and that's the other big attack vector, is there's a lot of older folks who are now using computers to stay in touch with the family who've never really used them before.
You're right. And, of course, they were not only with the pandemic, but LinkedIn for pictures of the grandkids and all that kind of stuff. And they know enough to be dangerous, but not enough to save themselves. One of the things going along with it that I see a lot of are the old analog scams, the low-tech scams, the telephone scams, where someone will call you on the phone, say they're from the power company, and your bill is overdue, and if you don't pay right now, well, they're going to disconnect your power. My favorite was the one and this is actually going around, that said, we need to verify your bill with your credit card number. What is it? And I think to myself, there can't possibly be somebody who would fall for that. But there are.
And yet there are. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, I often think that, you know, the scams themselves are probably as old as human civilization. It's really the delivery technology that's changed.
Exactly.
And you're exactly right, because before there were computers, there was the telephone. Before there was the telephone, I'm sure there was the telegraph. Before that, I'm sure it was the mail and the Pony Express, right? It's always some kind of con that takes advantage of some bad guy who pretends to be something they're not, or delivering a service that they don't have, and a gullible or vulnerable person who's willing to pay for that.
Right, and on other than the Nigerian, we have $10 million for you scams. Most of the really successful ones are based upon the logo of a company you're likely to use. Now, they might not know if you're with Citibank or Chase or Bank of America, but they're sending out emails with all of these different logos to everybody, hoping they hit pay dirt. And, of course, if you do bank online, you are going to get emails from these individuals, unlike phone calls from the power company, which will never happen. Try to get them on the phone. But with regard to any of your online banking or whatever, you're hearing from these people regularly. So what's the giveaway? And some of them are good. And I know you know that. But what's the giveaway that maybe this isn't what I should be dealing with?
Well, there's a couple of giveaways. And first and foremost, you know, the fact of the matter is, phoning the bank or phoning the institution that's contacted you via email is always a free and the best verification option, right? So if you're getting an email from someone asking you for money or identification, the first thing I would do is just call the bank, right? Talk to somebody. Did you send this mail? Did this really happen, right? One of the common scams is our database has gone down, or we've changed our accounting system. We need to re-verify your information, right? We need to, or your account has expired. We need to re-verify your password. Call them up, right? Find out if this is legitimate. I personally would never enter any kind of financial or personal identification on an unsolicited email. And so, you know, I think that's really the kind of giveaway for me. And what I warn people is, someone's contacting you out of the blue, asking for stuff like a password reset, or asking about, you know, your address or stuff like that, that's immediately a red flag to me. You know, let's call them up. Let's contact a human being. And let's find out what's really going on.
Yeah, and as far as contacting them, I mean, I recognize that you may never get to your branch again in life itself, because they're off for whatever reason. But every major bank has a call center with people who will answer it somewhere, and they will be able to answer these basic questions, because they'll know if they're resetting security, which they're probably never doing anyway, at least not in that way, one would hope. But the thing that I always do is, no matter what the email is, even if I'm convinced that it's from Scotiabank, one of my banks, I will not click on the link there. I'll separately go to a link. I'll pull out a browser and say, I'll type in Scotiabank or whatever. And I find that many people are willing to click on links, and I would never do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the first rule of safe internet browsing, is never click on a link, right? Never click on a link from an email. Never click on a link from a social media message. Never click on a link from an SMS message, right? Yeah. If in doubt, type it in yourself. So that's absolutely 100% the correct way to go, because not only can they redirect you using various tricks to going to a site you think you're going to, but is actually delivering malware, there's also this concept of web address shortening services like Bitly, mm-hmm. which they will condense a website down into 3 or 4 characters, and you never even know where you're being sent to. So always, always best to type it in yourself manually.
Right, and so if you've got kids who are now online and all that, take a moment and find out from the schools what their URLs are and write them down. Because if you haven't gotten them yet, you're going to get these emails. They will be. It's just, you know, too much low-hanging fruit for somebody not to try and go after this. And
Right. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and unfortunately, you know, the children online open up a whole new area of attack for bad guys, and some of it's really kind of a dark place. And so people should be especially vigilant nowadays with their kids spending so much time online.
Right, and have certain household rules. Maybe it's just depending on the age of the kids that, no, they don't get to go to email, that that's something that mom or dad handles, because I think it's going to be
exactly
very hard to teach a 9-year-old what's okay to open and what's not.
Right, and the same thing goes with social media. I mean, there should just be certain rules set down. You know, if someone introduces themselves to your child online and starts asking kind of, you know, personal information or kind of creepy information, that's a warning sign. Certainly don't be sending any photographs or exchanging any kind of stuff like that online. And all that, you know, requires a certain amount of observing on the parent side and a certain amount of trust in the child that they can tell their parents. So, you know, it's a really dangerous avenue when it comes to kids online and no supervision.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And we're going to see more and more of this coming up this fall, certainly. And I don't pretend to know much about the dreaded Windows, but I'm reasonably sure that that's probably the operating system that most of these schools are going to be using. Is there an easy way for a parent to lock out things like the email program or like social media things? Is there an easy way, you know, a few keystrokes where you can make sure the kid can't go there?
You can. There's a couple of things you can do. There are applications. One of them for Windows called AppLocker, which puts a password on certain applications, you know, maybe the email client. You know, and that kind of stuff. You can also, depending on how sophisticated you are, a lot of the home routers that connect you to the internet allow you to block sites, either, you know, all the time, or you can actually set up times where people can go on their YouTube or whatever video sharing site or gaming site and watch. But what's interesting, a lot of schools, you know, fortunately, in some sense, you know, the year's 2021, there's been a lot of experience with PCs. We're not talking about the early 90s. When all this stuff is new. And there are specific operating systems now used by schools that are completely locked down. There's a version of Windows, Windows S, which is specifically designed for schools, which gives very little, all the functionality is controlled by the school administrators. There's also Chromebooks are very popular now in schools also, which offer the same kind of control for the school administrators. So I know my kids are issued laptops from their school, but they can only go to the websites that are designated by the school as safe.
That's good. I know they're giving away a lot of those Chromebooks because, of course, they're very low cost. And yes, that Windows S can just be a horror if you're not wanting that protection. But most everything is shipping with. Oh, speaking of those horrors, okay. So here's my horror. All right, hogging you for my personal disaster here.
That's what I'm here for.
Yes, I got the new 2020 MacBook Pro. I didn't really want to. I wanted to wait for the Intel chip, but my last MacBook Pro decided, no, I wasn't waiting. So here it is.
Right.
And of course, like all people long of tooth, we develop these programs we like that, of course, the operating system will have eliminated in, say, I don't know, 2012, right? And in my case, it's just a little thing on OS X that was called Network Diagnostics. Now, not wireless diagnostics or network. It was a very simple program. And what I always used to do was, because after OS X 10.12, it won there, is I just went ahead and added it myself to core services. How hard is that? You know, and all this kind of stuff. Well, on Catalina, it's easier to invade Ethiopia than break core services. So tell me how to do it.
I believe, isn't that functionality, hold on, I want to just look, because I believe that functionality is now part of Activity Monitor.
Well, I can't get into it.
Is that the case now?
I don't know. I can't get into it. I know that. And I've tried everything. And I, you know, before you went through a few hoops and okay, that's fine. But it seems now like OS X with Catalina wants to separate the program into one part that's read only. And of course, I think those are read only are 2 4-letter words for me. That's for darn sure. And so.
Well. That's a big problem with all things Apple.
Yeah,
right?
Well,
I was a big Apple guy myself, but they have completely removed the intelligent user aspect, right? It's now become a creative platform and not a developer or enthusiast platform.
Right.
And so, you know, one of my things that annoy me, if we want to sit here and vent for 2 minutes,
well, sure.
I have VPNs set up, right?
Yes.
Virtual private networks, which allow me to connect securely to other places.
Me too.
And I use a technology called PPTP,
right?
Which is older fashioned, but it is absolutely compatible with everything.
Right.
Well, now except Mac, because in Catalina, they decided they were no longer supportive.
Right. Yeah,
and
no,
it's
I
such
saw
a pain that.
That
they ultimately decide what they, you know, it's best for you because we're Apple, we've decided.
Right. Right. And like you, I became enamored with Apple when DOS went to Windows, because I love keystrokes, and DOS was fine for me, but it was like, okay, so DOS is now trying to be Mac, I'll just get a Mac. And the beauty of it was, like you say, that if you knew what you were doing, there was nothing off limits. It didn't obfuscate them the way Windows did. I was pleased. And now, of course, it almost like iOS is encroaching in my life, and I don't want no iOS. I made apps for iOS once.
Future.
Never again. Yes, I know it is, because us OS X.
Like ARM.
Yeah, us OS X people are what? ARM is going to be iOS based.
Yep. Well, they're going to do something along those lines, and it's just going
to
be terrible.
Well, it is, and see, I'm a very old dog, and I haven't wanted to take the time to learn the Linux new trick, but I'm afraid I might have to, because this is just unacceptable to me, and I have a feeling I'm not alone.
I agree.
Yeah.
No, I'm right there with you. I've taken the Linux plunge.
Oh, have you?
A little while ago. It's awfully entertaining. It's all the fun you used to have setting up stuff.
Yeah.
But you certainly don't want to support your family on it.
Well, that's exactly right. And, of course, the other thing is that the longer of tooth we get, the less time we have to do things. And so I look at it on my to-do list, and it's somewhere above Learn Vedic Astrology, but it's below a lot of other things. And, you know, I don't know. But I have a feeling it is going to be the future. But at this point, given Catalina, I almost think that the dreaded Windows 10 is actually in some ways more forgiving.
It is, but it also doesn't have the quality control that we've grown accustomed to with things Apple. Although they've fallen down also, it's become nearly intolerable with Windows. Every update ushers in some kind of malfunction that is dreadfully serious if you get affected by it.
I'll tell you how serious. I wound up having to abandon an automation platform for one of my radio stations because it would be off the air with every update. And this idea that, oh, well, you can delay your updates. You can't delay your virus definitions. There are things that you just cannot delay. And, of course, I don't like that about it either. It seems that it should be my choice how exposed I choose to be or not. But I
completely agree. But, you know, you have to, especially, you know, as it relates to what we've been talking about here, is that we're kind of unique. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, it was the cool thing to be playing with this stuff. And only people who enjoyed playing with it were really playing with it. But right now, my grandmother is online.
Well, right. No, I
didn't. And so what we need to do, though, is we need to be able to convince these software developers that people can take responsibility for their own systems. That's what really bothers me.
Right.
That I understand why they need to put in all these safety nets, but I know what I'm doing, so let me control my destiny.
Exactly. And that's the thing. I agree with you totally that you want to protect all the school kids and all the grandmas and everybody else. But make us jump through a few hoops, which we'll know how to do, and then let the world be our oyster. And it seems that you know, my feeling is I bought this operating system. I'll decide how I'm going to use it. And it does seem like that's not going to be our option anymore. And it's going to be interesting to see where Linux goes because of this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you're always going to have this cadre of hardcore enthusiasts who like playing with this stuff. And I think that a lot of the innovation comes from folks who get down in the weeds and play with the systems, not only the programming languages, but the actual systems themselves. But, you know, I think as a group, we sold our souls to the devil, if you will, when we started accepting the way software was delivered via mobile phones and tablets, and the whole concept of app stores, and the whole concept of lockdown operating systems.
Oh.
And once they've become so popular, you know, the desktop is just, it's a dying breed.
Well, it is. And for that reason, my own protest, I don't have a phone. I don't have a tablet. I lug the laptop everywhere I go because I just will not not support that. But I realize that I'm a party of one in most of that. We're talking to Jason Glassberg, ethical hacker, co-founder of Kasaba Security. If you've got questions, and yes, of course, we'll get to cryptocurrency and more, we'd love to hear from you. 888-876-5593. It's 888-88-ROLLYE. I'm Raleigh James. It's WGN Radio. Surprised that record only made it to number 49 nationally on the pop charts. It was much bigger than that. 1983 on Capitol, Thomas Dolby, She Blinded Me with Science. Only charter for this British musician. Today he's teaching at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore at the Peabody Conservatory. And from the very beginning, he blended technology with music and has been involved in everything from Silicon Valley startups to George Clinton records. So I figured that was apropos for the subject at hand. Jason Glassberg, ethical hacker, co-founder of Kasaba Security, and cryptocurrency business advisor. So, I got to ask Jason, with all this news about the coin shortage, I would assume that's kind of mana to those wanting to develop a cryptocurrency.
Well, yes. You know, it's kind of interesting that people are running out of coins. It's almost like paper fiat currency. You know, any kind of physical currency is kind of like a thing in the past. I personally can't remember the last time I had a $20 bill in my pocket, to be honest with you, because with all of the payment schemes via, you know, your phone and being able to pay with stuff online, it's almost like it's, you know, yesterday's technology, if you will.
Well, absolutely. And I think the people who are hell-bent on cash tend now to be people who are focused on what kind of dog?
English Bull Terrier.
Oh, how nice. Well, Wolf, back at you. All right, so I think focused on privacy, which is one of the things that that cryptocurrencies offer, a degree of anonymity. I say a degree because to some extent the idea of that the security in it is that it's now on a lot of platforms and a lot of computers. The information's there, but not to whom it belongs. And so I would assume that that's still a big selling point about cryptocurrency, that you control it.
It is, but, you know, the problem is, like anything else, it's a very sophisticated topic. You know, I do work in the field, most especially, you know, programmatically and system-wise, but I wouldn't claim to ever really fully understand the whole you know, concepts behind it. And yet you have folks who really don't have any concept whatsoever, happily throwing tens and thousands, you know, tens of thousands of dollars into these systems and websites claiming to be able to sell this stuff without having any knowledge of any of the risks whatsoever. So it's almost like open. This is one of the classic open seasons for fraudsters.
Oh, yeah.
With these exchanges. And in fact, there have been an almost countless number of breaches against these exchanges. Mm-hmm. And because the money is untraceable, you can lose your investments in a heartbeat.
And that's happened, as you well know.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are those who say, oh, well, that won't happen anymore. But, oh, yes, actually, at this point, it will. I think that the, what was it, 2019, there were 11 major breaches in 1 year alone. And,
right.
You know, I remember seeing that on ZDNet, but there are, it's certainly not, not the first and won't be the last. But when I look at it in terms of, at least philosophically speaking, it really is no different today than hard bills and coins in terms of we're not backed by gold or silver. It's
right.
Money has value based upon we believe in it. And so at this point, Bitcoin, the big daddy of the cryptocurrencies, is really more speculative. I look at it more of an investment for the future, if you want to look at it that way, than something people are actually using. And perhaps over time, this will get that level of acceptance. But I would think right now that fear, healthy fear of what this is probably what's keeping it from becoming ubiquitous.
I think so. And I think, quite frankly, there's also an enormous amount of government pressure against it, right? Because one of the main powers of any government is their ability to control the currency, whether it's openly sure. traded, based on someone else's currency, or completely, you know, valued whatever they think, right? This is the economic source of power. And when you start going into the Bitcoins of the world and the Ethereums and all that, all of a sudden they lose the ability, right? Not to mention the ability to tax it.
Absolutely. And, of course, the way they are trying to pass laws and regulations to outlaw the practice of it in the given country, it's so easy for them because they talk about all the illegal funds, it's for the children, or whatever, that
right.
all manners of Hades will descend on you if you allow this to be legalized. And so there are a lot of things against it that way for development. But I do find it ironic that there really is no difference in terms of its value than the almighty dollar or anything else. I don't know of any currency worldwide that is backed on anything legit like gold or silver or something that has value. Is there one?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Right.
But, you know, that's the whole concept of fiat currencies, right, is that they're based on something other than some standard.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, it's and that's, and of course, at that point, the value of whatever money you're talking about is intrinsically tied to the stability and economic health of whatever country has that, you know, is issuing that currency. At least in an openly traded market.
Right. Right. Now, if
you know, countries like China, it's kind of stacked because the government, it tells you what the value of their yuan is, as
right.
opposed to the U.S., where it's an openly traded dollar.
Well, as you, this is terrible to ask you to do this, but I'm going to make you a seer now, look into your crystal ball. If you had to look down the road, what is the trajectory? I don't even want to say what the future, because there is a future. But what is the trajectory of how cryptocurrencies are going to go as opposed to, say, the almighty central banks?
Yeah, I have to believe there's going to be some kind of synthesis, because I don't think you can have one without the other, right? There is no way you're going to have countries give up their ability to control, you know, monetary policy. But there might, you know, there's certainly nothing better than having the kind of digital, in terms of convenience, right, the digital ability of digital wallets and whatnot that these kinds of bitcoins and digital currencies provide. Now, what I think is interesting is where the private sector fits into this, right? Because you had that whole rigmarole with Facebook just a couple of months ago where they tried to make this industry standard Libra as, you know, their digital currency. Now, whether it's because, at the end of the day, people, you know, hardly trust Facebook with their data. Are they really going to trust it with their money?
Exactly.
or was it because there was just an enormous pressure from various governments that said there's no way you're going to be able to walk all over, you know, our monetary policy is interesting. And yet we look for these companies to provide the innovation in our lives that supposedly move us forward and make us better, right? There would be none of these digital currencies or any of this technology if it wasn't for the private sector. So how it melds with the public sector and public banking processes and policies is really going to be fascinating. And that I don't have an answer there, except there's going to have to be some kind of partnership.
Well, it's interesting you say private, because, of course, the Federal Reserve is neither federal nor a reserve. It technically is a private bank, as is the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, to which it answers. And so I would assume that it's going to be some type of relationship with the existing powers that be. I don't know how what form that'll take, but what is easy, like you mentioned, motivating people with fear, what is particularly easy is just have more of these exchanges lose hundreds of millions of dollars more, and there may be people who are going to be willing to trust some names they know. So I wonder if there's going to be some very unholy alliances coming out in the not too distant future.
It's really kind of we're almost at a crossroads now, and it can kind of the scale could fall either way.
Yeah.
The other thing, you know, so obviously there's an incentive to go and attack these exchanges, take the money and run, right?
Yeah.
So that gives you this immediate gratification, and it's, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But what happens if you're far more cunning? And you attack these exchanges not to necessarily cash them out, but to manipulate them very slowly, very carefully, in ways that aren't necessarily apparent. You know, that has some serious long-term ramifications. And I don't think we're at the point technologically that we can, you know, trust our systems that they cannot be attacked and are 100% perfect.
Oh, I agree with that, and you're right. Oh, that's delicious for somebody who wants to ultimately control. Incrementalism is their friend. We're talking to Jason Glassberg, ethical hacker, co-founder of Cassava Security. And if you would like to join the discussion, this is the time to get on that phone. 888-876-5593, 888-ROLLYE. I'm Raleigh James, and it's WGN Radio.
Love ain't nothing but a monkey on your back. No, love ain't nothing but a monkey on your back. Well, you better watch out, boy, or love will lead you down a one-way track. Well, I found out that love ain't nothing but a word. Yeah. But a word.
That's the birthday boy, Johnny Nash, who turned 80 yesterday. Love ain't nothing but a monkey on your back. He's from Houston originally and best known for all his reggae stuff, like I can see clearly now. But this has a Chicago connection. It was on Argo in 1964. No, it didn't chart. Originally, he was a pop standard singer. In fact, his first charter was in 1958, cover of a Doris Day record, Very Special Love. And he did a great job with those. Have no idea how he wound up on Argo, but maybe someone in Chicago can tell me someday. I'm Raleigh James. It's WGN Radio. And you can join us at 888-876-5593, 8888-Raleigh. And we're talking with Jason Glassberg, an ethical hacker and co-founder of Cassava Security. Cybercrime costs $445 billion annually. And a breach hurts everybody, obviously. Costly data loss, bad PR, expensive fixes, and Kasaba can help you out with all that. But, you know, those figures raise the next question. As you were saying earlier, when's the last time you spent cash? Well, every time you don't, you're engaging in some type of an electronic transaction. And unlike some countries worldwide, America doesn't have a great track record of punishing those who abuse that fiduciary responsibility. How can we protect ourselves from someone else's breach?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting problem. So we've got what they call supply side or client side attacks happening now. Now, what's interesting is generally systems are built not by one person, and as well as you would know this, not by one person sitting in a corner designing an entire website or e-commerce site. Generally, sites are built with components taken from other companies or other open source projects and built together, and all of these sources are combined. And recently, there's been a vast increase in what's called this client-side MagCart attack, which essentially is someone using a vulnerable component in their server, not on your PC, but the server you're connecting to and giving your credit card information. And that malicious component is siphoning off or scraping off your credit card information and sending it off to the bad guys and, you know, taking advantage of the fact that you've now lost your credit card information. And what's especially insidious about it is there's absolutely nothing the end user can do, right? The only way you can protect yourself is to monitor your credit card statements. And this is a, you know, obviously we can sit there and preach to folks, run antivirus, be very careful, don't click on links, make sure you go to known websites. But, you know, the real problem is what happens when you go to a website that has already been compromised and you don't know about it.
Exactly. And that is the real problem. And as I say, some countries are proactive in really making it hell to pay for those who are hacked in that way. And the standards are such that there's real fear. Now, sadly, in America, our track record is people can be hacked and not bother to tell you about it for, I don't know, a year or what have you. We don't tend to have things with much teeth where, yes, obviously it's going to be expensive for those who were hacked, and it's going to be a PR nightmare and so many other things. But by and large, there's not the kind of teeth that, say, a Germany would have. And is that something anyone's working on?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, right now, this whole business of GDPR privacy breaches is you know, hugely important, because GDPR is kind of an interesting process, and that's the European Privacy Data Protection Law. And because anything or anyone who uses a system or touches a person or an employee or a data object that is in some way related to this GDPR clause or law is then falls under it, right? And mm-hmm. So that's literally three quarters of the world now. It falls under this GDPR law, and companies are facing some absolutely gigantic fines. You know, British Airways, for example, was caught in a breach, and they had to pay almost $60 million just in fines, which was pretty remarkable. Yeah, it is good. But I would come back and say, you know, the attitude in the U.S. is absolutely changing, because there are breach reporting laws. And so if you get a breach of a certain size, you need to publicly report that. And before those laws, things were kind of, you know, pushed under the rug. Very sorry to have had that happen. But the real sea change happened in the Home Depot breach. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
2 years ago.
Absolutely.
And what was fascinating about that was not the breach, right, which at the time was like a couple of million, you know, data records, which sadly by today's standards is just nothing.
Right, so 56 million, yes.
Right. The outcome of that, though, was felt all the way up to the C-suite, right? So it literally cost the CIO and the CTO and all these C-level guys their jobs.
Which it should.
And that was absolutely. And that was the very first time that there was actually repercussions at that level of a company's bureaucracy. And it really, you know, we see it as a data protection provider for companies who come in to make sure their systems are secure. That was literally the night and day difference, right? Because all of a sudden, companies cared, and the guys who wrote the checks cared, and the folks who sat up in the big offices in the corner cared, because not only was it a public relations nightmare, not only did they have to report these things, but their jobs now are on the line. And so, you know, we've seen a slow but steady improvement in the whole attitude towards this protection. And interestingly now, California, which, you know, for better or worse, tends to lead the country in certain areas, emission controls and all that stuff, has instituted their own data privacy law, mimicking GDPR. So my guess would be it's only a matter of time before that kind of law, if not that law, is adopted throughout the country.
I have a feeling I know exactly what we're going to talk about on our next visit. Thank you for spending the hour with me, Jason. We will do it again.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
All right. Ethical hacker Jason Klasberg, owner of Kasaba Security, cryptocurrency business advisor, and more. So check it out. Yeah, Jason Klasberg. Interesting stuff.